1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. From 13 on, if you can.
13, 14, 15, 16, 17.
The top line of this tape is Peter Godwin Chance. The second line is Commander. The third line is Royal Canadian Navy, brackets, retired, spelt in full, close the brackets. Peter, thank you for coming this third time this afternoon on the 1st of October 1982 in, where are we in, Victoria. I know you know that, but this is for the record. Period. When we finished your second tape, you just told me that you had returned to Canada. Would you like to go on from there, please?
Yes, Hal. You'll recall that in the summer of 1945, after I had spent January to around June, I guess it must have been, no, July, as I was meant to have gone as XO of Gatineau, but for some little in-house change that this didn't come off, but I was, in point of fact, acting in a kind of XO sort of role, rather strange, but it all worked out very handsomely. But then, in July, I was transferred to the 2nd Ottawa, and she had already had many, well over millions of miles, a million miles in the Mediterranean before we got her. And we continued to do this business of trooping until such time as we got into Sydney for the final time, and we paid her off into the Point Edward Naval Base. It was rather a sad kind of situation to see that this was the end of a fine ship, and unless I'm mistaken, and I sometimes get these mixed up, the 2nd Ottawa was the, originally she was HMS Griffin, and there were little bits of mementos hither and yon, but most of them of anything that was worth keeping from a relics standpoint went to the Maritime Museum, so far as I know, through the supply services that naturally took everything and took it ashore. Well, I then went back to Ottawa, where my family was, and I hadn't seen them for some time. In fact, the son had been born in my absence. We then all trundled down to Halifax.
Let's get this boy's name into history.
Yes, well, his name is Simon, and he was born on the 24th of September. And, strange enough, my commanding officer at the time was Commander Jeffrey Davidson. And in passing, I should report, I have never met a better seaman. An outstanding seaman. He taught me anything that I ever knew, and goodness knows, one always has plenty to learn, but I had a rather strange feeling that I wasn't bad at it as time went on. But he was a master insofar as ship handling was concerned. And moreover, he was particularly sensible to my marital problems. That is to say, it would be rather nice if it could be arranged that I might be there for the launching of number one child. And
as well as the laying of the keel.
Well, I don't know whether I don't think he was present for that. Anyway, the point, I guess, was that I was allowed to skip the trip, and another good old friend who lives here nowadays, his name is Smith, and you know him as well as I do.
Not Chris.
Christopher Gordon Smith himself. He took over for me for one trip as XO in Ottawa, and but I, of course, was too early, and so I went back to sea without having accomplished the prescribed mission. Nonetheless, in November of that year, I guess it must have been by that time, I returned to Halifax, where the then Captain Ken Adams was the commanding officer of the barracks. And Admiral Pierce was then commander, D.W. Pierce. He was the commander of the barracks. Jeff Davidson became the first lieutenant. And I had the magnificent job of being assistant to the first lieutenant. And I can assure you that had it not been for a most redoubtable and magnificent character named Bunker Hill, whom I got to know very well over the years and who allowed me to tape his life story, which I subsequently was able to give to the Maritime Museum here in Victoria, all was such that we had a very excellent working relationship.
Excuse me, interrupting your train of thought, but other people have mentioned Bunker Hill, but only in passing. Last man said, those type of men made us RCNVR, is what we were, because apart from them, we just taught ourselves.
Well, this is absolutely right, as you know. And
Tell us about Bunker Hill.
Well, Bunker, when I first met him, was the bosun of the yard in the repair facility at Shelburne, when Skeena had gone down to do a refit in the wintertime down there in 1943, I guess it must have been. Because I joined her down there after having been, when I came back from the Far East. Anyway, and after subs courses. But the Bunker struck me as the most remarkable character, with his gruff, full voiced Cockney accent that never altered one whit from the first time I met him to the last time, which was many years later in 1962, when I was exo of Shearwater, and by this is the time when I did the tapings of him, of his life story. But when I found that, in point of fact, that he was, if not number one boy seaman on the books of the Royal Canadian Navy, he was very near it. And he was one of these Barnardo boys that came out to Canada in 1909, and subsequently was in Toronto, he told me, and he saw an advertisement to pick crops down in the Niagara Peninsula, and he went down there, and again he heard by 1910 we are now that we were going to start a Royal Canadian Navy. And so he said, rock. And he went into London to a recruiting station there. And they said, right, we're going to have to do this and the other thing. And eventually, of course, he ends up in Halifax. And then sent back to the UK, where he joined either the Niobe or the Rainbow. I'm not quite sure. It'll be on my tapes. But of course, the story goes on and on.
Well, tell about his influence on you.
Well, his influence on me, as far as the assistant to the first lieutenant, first of all, he was a splendid character and a true rogue. He was all for the service, both hands, and nothing was other than he was nothing. If he was nothing else, he was absolutely loyalty itself, and full of fun. Quite clearly had an extremely interesting but rugged life, and always had something good to say for someone else. And his son, also known as Bunker, eventually, so far as I know, he certainly was in command of frigates, certainly one, and then I lost track of him. By this time he was lieutenant commander, and that was about 1965, I guess. But Bunker, In 1945, when I first met him again, and he was the kind of bosun of the yard. He was everything. And when we young kids, young two-stripers by this time, and there were a number of us around the campus, when we needed a hand for something or other, one could always go to Bunker, and then somewhere along the line some help would be provided one way or another. It was just terrific, and I have admired him always for just that. Anyway, always a good laugh, too. So then, I'm still in the barracks, and I had had some skating experience and had done quite reasonably well, although not enormously well. And Ken Adams got a hold of me and he said, which was a little bit incongruous, he said, we want a manager for the Navy hockey team. Oh, yes. Fine. So, for the winter of 1945-46, I was the manager of the Navy hockey team, which consisted mostly of NHL players who were drafted in from God knows where else to serve either in Stad or in Cornwallis. And of course the team was terrific. They were absolutely outstanding. They had a perfectly good coach, but they needed somebody. I began to wonder why, but anyway, it gave me something to do as the manager. And anyhow, in addition to that, I also got involved with a local figure skating club and assisted them in a half-baked fashion as a sort of unpaid pro, because, of course, in those days, one could never, in a million years, had another job. It was just not on. So I used to go and teach these people, and they gave me a sort of a little honorarium in which... as a two-striper with a young, growing family, I can assure you, I was very glad for anything that came along. Well, that was through the winter. And in the spring of 1946, I was sent to become the first permanent force staff officer and... what was I called? I was a staff officer and something or other officer... at HMCS Carleton, the staff officer, that's right. Well, there were a number of us in that same role. I think of Skinny Hayes, Peleg Cayley, Miles Steele, who else was in this caper? Don Saxon. Right across the country, they placed birds such as myself in these positions. And you must understand, of course, the Navy was rolling right down by this time, and the idea was, let's get out as fast as we can. In the meantime, the recruiters were trying to get new people in, and so there was a very positive reason to keep those Naval Reserve divisions going. Well, we had a ship's company of 37 souls, including mostly supply people and others known as stokers to take care of the furnace. And that was about it. As far as I was concerned, I had a most delightful man, whom I had known before, whose name was Tim Healy. And he had been a chief petty officer in the Ottawa division when I, in 1938-39, he was now the bosun.
H-E-A-L-E-Y.
And Percy Healy, known as Tim, I'm sure he's long since left us, but he again was a tower of strength to me, because quite apart from the activities that were the norm, as it were, throughout my 1 year that I was there, from the spring of 46 to the spring of 47, there was one event that was outstanding, and that was what we call the Veterans Housing League incident. And this is one that took place on the 24th of September 1946, when a group of about 300 men, women, and children, with another 300 sort of hangers-on, with about 20 moving vans, Fourniers, Capital Storage, etc., physically stormed the barracks and forced their way in, and at which time we had very little warning, although we knew who these people were. They were headed up by a man by the name of George Blakeney, an Ottawa lawyer, and another chap named It'll come back to me in a minute. Hanrahan or something like that. Anyway, these two were all fired up with the notion that veterans were being given a very hard time by the government and that something ought to be done to ensure that adequate housing was being provided. Hence the Veterans Housing League, they called themselves. And they carried all sorts of favor with a large number of relatively speaking, ne'er-do-wells, hangers-on, and so on. And they were encouraged to the point that there all sorts of minds got inflamed. They had parades on Parliament Hill, that kind of thing. And the upshot of it was that, which we learned later, that the Russian embassy got very interested, and they provided funds for a secretary and monies and that kind of thing to provide the support in the organization.
Just the barracks, HMCS Carlton?
Yes, undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what did they do when they got inside?
Well, what they did was, and very interesting, at the time of the strike, as it were, which was about 5:15 in the evening, on that afternoon of September, and whereas they had gone by naval headquarters, and another good friend who's since left us, what's his name? McCall, Ginger McCall, was on duty, and Ginger rang my house. No, he rang the barracks, and they rang me, and so that I did a race out the driveway to get to the barracks, and I was just in advance of the oncoming column that was coming down Preston Street, heading towards the barracks. From the north-south, heading south. And there was a most delightful guy, a terrific fellow. His name was David Franklin Olive, who was a descendant of Sir John Franklin, who was again a reserve active officer at Carleton, who with me jumped in my car, and we said, right, we better do something. And so I drove my vehicle into the leading moving van, which was quite exciting, although we didn't do it at any great speed. The name of the game was to create an obstruction rather than to write off my vehicle. Anyway, we got there, and everything halted, you see. And by this time, the then Captain Louis Odette, who was a most marvelous man, for whom I have the greatest respect. He was around, and also a Rear Admiral Hugh Pullen, who was Director of Naval Reserves, was fascinated and excited and angry, and I don't blame him for any of those things. And he was saying, "Switch on the hoses and turn off the lights," and all sorts of fixed bayonets and so on, which was, I'm sure, under almost any other set of circumstances, would be warranted. But we hadn't been able to read a riot act, and it was all very serious, and so we had to sort of keep things as calm as possible.
I've got some questions. Were there veterans from all three services, or
well,
no veterans?
We found out later about the so-called veterans. It's rather a laugh, unfortunately.
Right, there's
however,
that to answer, and I've forgotten the second question.
Anyway,
what did they do when they got inside?
Well, exactly. There was no question but that as the very excited men who were armed, and most of them had several drinks, and the way they came in was they put the women, the children, in front of the women, and they marched them ahead, and the men hung on the trucks, and the trucks pushed the whole thing forward. So there was no way that we could forcibly attempt to withhold this crowd without creating an enormous backlash.
What were
by
they
virtue,
armed?
The what men were armed with pistols, that kind of thing. But it was obvious that they were armed. But as we found out and proved later, that they were too. There were no visible rifles or anything of that sort. Nonetheless, The next thing that happened was that my vehicle, a 1938 Chev of considerable vintage and many hundreds of thousands of miles with clocks turned back, was forcibly lifted off the road by these people with David Olive and I in it, and was set aside. And so literally, it was an enormous effort. The whole blasted car was just... And then on came these people, the whole sort of entourage, caravans, and they moved in. Well, by this time, and you must understand, of course, that the property is outside the Ottawa police jurisdiction, with DND property and therefore RCMP. Well, the RCMP appeared in great numbers, but it was a little late because they were there. So what we said was, right, we'll lock them in. And so that's exactly what we did. And before the night was over, we had 19 families, and we had a new baby. And we provided the transportation to take the pregnant woman who was in this banditiero or whatever up to the Civic Hospital on Carling Avenue and have her child. So it's rather ironic. But the next thing that happened was, as I say, we then said, right. And we mounted an around-the-clock guard around the perimeter, and there was a large number of redcoats all on watch all day long, all night long. And this went on for 3 months.
They were locked in for 3 months?
They were locked in for 3 months. We wouldn't allow them to move. They were allowed to have milk and bread brought in, but nobody was allowed out. We confined them to them.
And you had turned over to civil authority by now, I guess.
Who? Sorry?
The Navy had turned over to civilian authority.
Oh, no.
The police were...
The RCMP were in charge.
Well, yeah, but not the Navy.
Oh, no, no, no. As far as the custody of these people were concerned, this was a police matter.
Yes.
And but on the other hand, by this time, the public sympathy was absolutely 100% for these poor incarcerated veterans and their families, who were bringing hot plates in and into those wooden barracks, And my God, we had a nightmare as to whether or not we were all going to go up in flames. And a tragic finale to this story did happen, in point of fact.
What was that?
Well, that on Christmas Day, they having been eventually evacuated very shortly before Christmas, after they were had up in court and found guilty of breaking and entering, and by this time that enormous wave of public sympathy had waned and withered and eventually turned around the other way and said, look, you're a bunch of bloody frauds. And they were eventually evicted, they were sent to an empty RCAF barracks out at Rockcliffe. And on Christmas Day, five of them died in a fire because they had some fat on the stove, which caught fire, and they had the flaming Christmas tree adjacent to the stove. Can you beat it? Anyway, that's what happened, unfortunately. But going back to this paper, because everyone was so inflamed, Chance was the only uniformed officer in Ottawa. Everybody was told to get out of uniform for a while. But I was in charge of the barracks. Now, that may not be absolutely quite correct. One would have to check that. But certainly, no one else was in uniform because they wanted to take the heat off. But they, on the other hand, they said, okay, something has to happen. And there had to be some show, and I was it. Well, thank goodness, there was a most marvelous man by the name of Raoul Mercier, and he was the Crown Counsel. And he got a hold of me and said, right, we're going to go into court. Have you ever done this sort of thing with him? Well, I've done it in a naval sense, of course, but I haven't been add up down on Nicholas Street where we were, indeed. And for 3 days, I was in the box, as it were. Well, the end of it was that, with crowds of people all fascinated by this endeavor, it was a circus, I can assure you. And the Judge Madden was in the chair, a marvelous guy who killed the motor car. What do you call it? Accident, subsequently, M-A-D-D-O-N. And the judge found the Hanrahan. and George Blakely to be guilty of breaking and entering, and they were fined $300 each, or
X days
in jail, 3 months or something of the sort. And so they eventually passed the hat around, and of course these poor, destitute veterans came up with the money just like that, you see, and of course once again they lost credibility. But what happened was, in point of fact, that not one of these people whom we, in a sense, incarcerated after they had broken in,
the 19 families,
yeah, not one of them, the men of the families, was a veteran from, insofar as that every one had been a conscript. One had been conscripted in the First World War, if you please, and he wanted his daughters to have a good time at the barracks, and they were soliciting at the barracks. And so once we sorted that out, things tidied up a little bit. And then the next thing was that all of the other people, again, had not been outside our country. And moreover, all of them had been conscripted in WW2. And again, every one of them had come from some reasonable housing. But they gave it up in order to get onto this kind of bandwagon because they, I don't know, they'd been promised something by these leaders, I guess. I don't know what.
Now, there was 100 or so in the march, but only 19 families locked in.
Oh, yeah, 19 families. And there were, four in a family sort of thing. But the rest all withered away.
They were dispersed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And an enormous number of hangers-on. Yeah. You know, it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, all kinds of traffic and everything else. Mm-hmm. So, but one of the end things of this was this. The two convicted characters came out at their own volition to Carlton, and with Hugh Pullum, and yours truly, and Leo Odette, and another man by the name of Superintendent LaPointe, RCMP, who was a then head of the Fingerprint Division, most fascinating guy. I had a long chat with him from time to time when he was up there. Because I was on watch too, you know. We did this 1-in-3 business again. And the two sort of senior officers of this crowd said, Blakely and Hanratty. Hanratty is the name, not Hanratty. Hanratty. H-A-N-R-A-T-T-Y. And whose father had been a bit of a rabble-rouser after the First World War, and Hanratty wanted to go into journalism. This is the whole thing. And he figured it was good stuff, and he was at Glebe, School of Commerce, which is in Glebe Collegiate in those days. Anyhow, they admitted that they... first of all, they said, look, we thought it was a great idea, and we believed in it, and I said, yeah, and everybody else said, yeah, fair enough. But we got off on the wrong track. And then when we got more and more support from outside, and we didn't really realize what was going on, then, of course, it got out of hand. And then when it actually went through, insofar as the attempt on the Princess Patricia barracks, which failed, which was in the city opposite the museum only a few days before, then we came out here and we were able to make it while we thought we were in business.
There was a previous one on the
on Argyle Street, just opposite the museum, where the RCAF WDs were billeted in there.
I know that one's by the museum.
Yeah. Anyway, the upshot of it was a public apology in the newspaper, and the thing all frittered away.
Who apologized to whom?
Well, these two apologized to the world at large and said that, look, you're terribly sorry, they made a mistake, made embarrassment calls, etc., etc. Which is very interesting because, you see, the press, once again, were absolutely flat out behind us, against us, until the thing all turned around. And then, once again, we're wearing saintly cloths and making like St. Joan sort of thing, you know, Brecht's Mail. Anyway, very shortly after all of this, we got up into March of 1947, and I was selected to take the long ND course. It had just been underway only a relatively very short length of time in the UK, and so off we went, packed our bags, and we went to the UK, where I sweated away trying to become a professional in the navigation and direction trade.
Julian Benmore was with you, was he not? He was over about that time.
No, Benny was the course before me, and I think he must have been with Starchy Brown, but I'm not sure.
I was doing my long G, and Benny was doing his long ND.
Yeah, well, I started in the spring of 47, and finished the spring of 48, so I think he must have been just before me. In any case, John, what on earth is his name? He died, he was killed in an air crash. Mason. John Mason. Nice guy. John and Ebo, his wife, who subsequently, when widowed, she married John Littler. And I don't know where they are nowadays. Some people say they may be living here, but I'm not sure. Maybe only from time to time. Maybe we certainly don't see them. But in any case, John Mason and I were the Canadians on that course. And we sweated away, and it was an enormous gruel as far as I was concerned, because I was not prepared. I hadn't been doing navigation prior to going to the course, whereas almost every other candidate on that course had come from a seagoing appointment as a navigator or as a direction type, and so they were streets ahead of the game. However, it all worked out in the long run, and in the spring of 1948 now, having done all the various courses, in Wales, down at the bottom of the land, below Milford Reach, there was the aircraft direction school called Keet, HMS Keet. K-E-T-E.
Yeah.
Right on the cliff side, 500-foot cliff to the bottom of David's Head. Anyway, we had a great time, and as I say, enormous, great strain, but we made it. And I suspect...